good day to you all. For me, it's a Sunday. For John Kenneth Muir, who is with me in this imaginary box, it is also a Sunday. Our time zones are mildly different. It's about 3 o'clock for me, about 10 o'clock for you.
Absolutely.
It is 10 o'clock for you or so. James McLean, John Kenneth Muir, this podcast at the moment for us has no title. It is that organic. The idea of this podcast, it's an irregular podcast, which we're doing through Beyond Cerberus, is basically, I kind of thought the idea is that we would get someone who is smart, articulate, well-read, and well-written, I guess, or well-written. I don't know quite how you'd put it as an author. Someone like John Kenneth Muir, who's sitting in this podcast with me, this imaginary room. You've written... How many books have you written now, John?
27.
27 books, all sitting around, sort of largely sitting around cult phenomenon of all sorts.
Absolutely. Cult TV, movies.
Horror, science fiction. And I kind of thought that it'd be good to do a podcast which sort of looks back, because you do a lot of looking back.
Yeah.
Especially with our ages not being too dissimilar. We looking back at the an earlier era of television. Which, to us, doesn't seem that early, but to a lot of people, it is. You know, I was talking to a professor who was doing a lecture actually, and mentioned it was a film from the 90s. It was I can't remember which one it was. It was Tombstone or something, and tried to call it contemporary film, and then stopped herself and went, no, I can't. That's like 25 years ago. So the period we're looking at is actually older than that. We're looking, so I was kind of thinking we look at sort of the 80s, some of the 70s, maybe a little bit of the 90s, sort of a retro look at sort of anything that's sort of slightly culty, I guess, which again is broadly is very questionably definable, isn't it? What's cult to you, John?
Well, I think when I think about cult TV historically, you know, I think of these little quirky things that, you know, disappeared after 7 or 8 episodes, but that people like you and I remember, like, you know, Quark or The Prisoner, even. I mean, of course you could put stuff in this, you know, like Doctor Who or The X-Files, things that last a long time and people do remember. But those are sort of examples where the cult went mainstream, in a sense. You know, that we're talking about, you know, things that came and went so fast, and yet for some people it galvanized their attention and they've never forgotten it 30 or 40 years later.
Wow, that's interesting. Maybe this should be called The Cult of Muir, or I was thinking, could we do a play on your name? Because listeners to this, while I will host this, as I say, the reason I thought this would work is because I think John is a repository of detailed data and commentary on this sort of era. So making it, I mean, he's the most unassuming guy you can meet, but making it sort of round him sort of gives it its sort of brand. So I was even thinking like Murder, She Wrote, but I don't know. I literally spent a week trying to think of puns around your name. So
please don't make it around my name. Please don't make it around me. You know, James, you are amazing. You are a vast repository of knowledge. You know so much. You have a great perspective on things. I'm thrilled to be here with you and to have the back and forth with you that, you know, I can be your sounding board and you can be mine. So let's think about a name that, I don't know, maybe is more about the subject. What do you think?
Well, hopefully when they listen to this, they'll know what name we picked. But right now, you, the listener, have more idea of what's going on here than we do, which is kind of cool. But I'll first off say, yeah, I mean, me and John know each other because I used to work. I still run Back to Frank Black, which was to do with Millennium, bringing Millennium, the Fox television show, back. John, as I say, has written 27 books. He has his website, Reflections on Film and Television, .blogspot.co.uk. So if you want to check any of his material out without having to pay money, go there. But obviously, if you want to pay money, go to one of the 27 books. And as I say, we just thought we would talk about some stuff from the past that might interest you, that I think is also, I think, of an American perspective. Because that has informed me. I think the one final thing I'll say about this before we move on is one of the reasons I think this is important is that, I mean, what I think we'll end up looking at, without it sounding too intellectual, is you know, how do these sort of things give us that sort of meaning? What do they mean to us? Why do they carry meaning? Why does a show that had six episodes still carry meaning for us? I mean, that's crazy. Even a show which has lots of episodes, why, you know, 30 years later, does that still reflect on us? Why, either as a nostalgia, or even in our minds, you know, culturally, you know, is this? I mean, I'll give you an example. I've got a cold, and John's got a cold as well. And before we started talking, I was thinking back when I was thinking of my voice at the moment. I feel it's got a slightly sexy tint to it. And I thought back. Do you remember that Friends episode from the 90s or 2000s where Phoebe has a cold? And did you ever see that one? And she's trying to sing, and she's enjoying it because it gives her a throaty sound. And she's really disappointed when the cold goes, because her voice goes back to normal and she's got her normal voice and she hates it. And again, it's just an example how that one episode, you know, 15 years ago, whenever it was aired, I'm not sure, really still resonates with me. It informs my memory. It informs how I think about things. So these sort of things are kind of cool.
Absolutely. It's, well, and you know, is it nostalgia? Was there some quality there? Were these things ahead of their time, or just so outside of the norm of what TV was at that point? Is that the reason that, you know, some people still remember them? And I hope too that, you know, we can draw people's attention to some things that maybe they don't know. I know I was terribly disappointed. This is even going back at, you know, some time when I was writing for a popular magazine in the early 2000s, and they said you can't write about any show that, you know, hasn't been seen by people who are 16-year-olds now. You know, it's like, oh
yeah,
well, that sort of limits it. You know, there's a whole universe out there of, you know, interesting things, and you know, the past is prologue. You know, it's if you love the shows now, think about what the shows were and what led up to that and what inspired it. What was the 1980s version of Game of Thrones? Was it Wizards and Warriors from 1983, or what have you?
Because it all interrelates. I think that's what we're trying to say. There is that sort of contextual element to everything. So it will inform everything else, which is kind of cool. Right. So if we're looking at... I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the era we're looking at, if you think of it sort of pre-X-Files... where, you know, Fox started to move, as I was saying to someone else recently, Fox started to move into sort of narrowing down its sort of the way that it dealt with its audiences. Rather than looking at broad audiences, you know, it was looking for specific audiences. So you get an era which you've got stuff which is, as you say, is memorable, but is also quite generic because it's there to try and broadly capture everyone. And I sort of said to John, one of the things we could talk about, first of all, I thought was Glenn Larson. And his canon of shows, because to me they are very much that. They are a mixture of same and difference. There's a lot of same in them, but they're all very unique in a sort of kind of cool way.
Right. And he, of course, was, I think it was Harlan Ellison who famously nicknamed him, I believe. If I'm not wrong, they called him Glenn Larceny. Because... some people believe they could detect a pattern in Glenn Larson's work where there would be a popular movie, yes. And then there would be his TV show, which seemed a lot like that movie,
yeah.
At least in conception.
And certainly that was a question which came up litigiously as well, if I recall, in a couple of examples. It's a great point, isn't it? There's a Buck Rogers book I read recently, and they made that same point. This, and they actually went down and went through... Can you name them if I sort of... So... Alias Smith and Jones, what did that riff from?
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Absolutely. what else have we got? I mean, obviously Battlestar Galactica.
What was that based on? No, I'm just kidding.
God. what could it possibly be based on?
Right. Star Wars, right?
Buck Rogers is an interesting one.
Of course, that was more an adaptation, but you could say it was still somewhat playing on the Star Wars... you know, the Star Wars boom at the time. But of course, if you look at Buck Rogers, it's much more like Burt Reynolds in space, you know.
So absolutely. I was wondering whether you were going to go there.
Absolutely. Burt, you know, it's the Burt Reynolds, you know, catalog from the 70s as a, you know, quasi Star Wars James Bond.
Yeah. Absolutely. He's playing a Burt Reynolds. You know, did the Fall Guy come before Buck Rogers?
It was after that, and there was a movie that folks might want to check out called Hooper, which some people have said is a sort of precursor, let's say, to The Fall Guy.
To The Fall Guy, yeah, I've seen that. That's the Burt Reynolds one, isn't it? Who's Hooper, yes. Burt Reynolds? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it's a good film, quite interesting film, and it's Burt Reynolds-ish sort of way. But yeah, so, I mean, inevitably, so much of his stuff, as you say, is sort of riffs or something which is currently... or has some cultural significance that he can roll from. And this, especially at the time, was not unusual, and still isn't, really, to be fair.
Right, and, you know, I've always sort of stood up for Glenn Larson, although some people thought I was arguing the opposite point. I said, you know, able to look at something that was popular and say, well, let's make something that people who liked that will like this. And for many years, that was the name of the game in what you do for television. That's how you made a television show back then. Wow, hey, what's popular? You know, let's do something like that. You know, it's not like it's specific thievery. It's like the idea of, well, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. So the next season, we're going to have all these shows about 1930s adventures, because obviously people love 1930s adventures, and we're going to have Tales from the Gold Monkey, and we're going to have Bring 'Em Back Alive, and we're going to have this, that, and the other thing. And you say, well, yeah, well, clearly those are, you know, ripoffs of Raiders of the Lost Ark, but not exactly. You actually look at them, and they have their own qualities. They have their own universe. It's more like the creation of them was inspired by the popularity of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So there's a little bit of a distinction there, you know?
And it's kind of funny sometimes how what they decide is the distinctive element. Like with Star Wars, you get a sort of British and sort of obvious sometimes a co-pro with America cycle of fantasy films, which is obviously informed by Star Wars. Things like Dragon Slayer and Krull. Sword and Sorcery, I think it was in the States. That, I suppose, so it wasn't just Britain, it was American as well. These sort of films where they obviously saw Star Wars and they thought that the genre it was really going to impact on was fantasy rather than science fiction. And so you see how they pull from that, as you say, to be because it's culturally popular, but they pull from it in a way that now you look back, you think, why the hell did you go in that direction?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, and it's still happening today. I mean, look, the Twilight movies, whatever you think of them, made a heck of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple years later, that sort of trickles down, to use a phrase, to television. And you get The Vampire Diaries and, you know, True Blood. You know, of course, they were both based on books as well. But you're having young, attractive vampire series after you've had a popular vampire series of films. And the point is that people like these things. So you want to offer them something like what they enjoyed before, you know. So, you know, people can decide whether the larceny, nickname that he was saddled with, is that fair, or was he just trying to pick up on sort of the zeitgeist and, you know, what was going on, and, you know, carry it forward to something else that was successful. You know, certainly Star Wars didn't have the Mormon qualities that Battlestar Galactica did. That was something that was pulled in, you know, originally into his, you know, sort of space adventure there. So you can see that there are differences between Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars. Yeah. Certainly, Star Wars lost the lawsuit, right? You know, which sort of validated the fact that Battlestar Galactica was its own thing, that it just happened to be a space opera, you know, with lasers and robots and
Han Solos and yeah. I think the funny thing with Star Wars is, I mean, as most people know, you know, there's so much borrowed from Kurosawa and so much borrowed from the sort of Flash Gordon serials. Visibly and intentionally, it's not stolen, but it's hard to really sort of say that Star Wars itself was an entirely unique beast.
Right. You know, if I can segue into a crazy story from my past, there was a time back in the year 2000, I went to Los Angeles to film an episode of a short-lived series called Sciography. It was like supposed to be like the biography of like sci-fi TV shows, and their first one was Battlestar Galactica, and I think they only aired two or three. But I brought with me a laser disc of Star Wars, and on the back of that laser disc, on the liner notes, George Lucas is quoted as saying, "I made Star Wars so a bunch of other filmmakers would copy it, and I could enjoy all of their space operas so I could see more of them." And so I read that, you know, in my interview for the show to prove really that, you know, Star Wars didn't have any grounds to, you know, say that Battlestar Galactica was a ripoff, considering. Mm. You know, Dune, Kurosawa, what have you, the dogfights from the World War II movies, yeah. You know, visually based on, all that stuff. And I said, and look here, there's even a direct quote from George Lucas saying that he made it this way so that he could see others like it. So it's really silly that there was a lawsuit. But, you know, I don't know if there was a legal issue, but they didn't put that in the aired product. but I always wished they had, because, like, I found a direct quote from George Lucas where he was like, you know, that's why I made Star Wars, so I could see all the other, you know, quote-unquote ripoffs. I thought, that's very strange. That's very strange. And, you know, you can't say that Battlestar Galactica is a ripoff of Star Wars after you've admitted that Star Wars is this, you know, pastiche of all of these, you know, Flash Gordon, Dune, other productions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you are listening to this, if you even go onto YouTube and throw up Flash Gordon Conquers Universe, you will get the same title trawl. And even John Williams' score carries some very similar motifs to what they were doing then. You know, so there's obviously intentions to, you know, I suppose that there is a difference between homaging and maybe capitalizing, I suppose their argument would be. But
right.
I agree with you. I tend to find that if we look at Battlestar Galactica, the actual core of it is very different to what Star Wars is doing.
That's how I feel.
Do you feel... Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, you know, it might have started out with its purpose was to capitalize on Star Wars, but through the course of the you know, whatever it was, 24 stories, 7 or 17 stories, because some were two-parters, whatever it was, that you got to, like, just because of the very nature of the medium, it being television, you got to be acquainted with the characters in Battlestar Galactica in a way that you didn't actually just from Star Wars at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It is a different beast, and it was doing a different thing. Do you find that Larson's pilots are always so much better than the films? I mean, that's the terrible thing I always find, is that if you look at Knight Rider, if you look at Buck Rogers especially... And okay, no, even Battlestar Galactica, their pilots are, in the end, because they're not bound so heavily by the conventions and politics of television, they end up being a far more sort of intellectual piece than the series that spawned them.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that there's something to be said about sort of that first, you know, flush creation and innovation in the pilots, and you know, you maybe have a little bit more money, you have a little bit more time generally. I mean, the pilot for Battlestar Galactica ended up being, you know, something like 3 hours when you had commercials in it, you know? It was like, wow. You know, you had a lot of time to go into things. Knight Rider, I think the pilot was 2 hours. I'm not 100% sure on that. Buck Rogers certainly was, you know, hour and a half at least when it was released in theaters. And also... You know, you're creating all these things, certainly in the case of Buck Rogers and Battlestar Galactica, that haven't been seen before, the special effects. You know, the thing that drags Battlestar Galactica down, I think, is, you know, the oppressive reuse of special effects, you know, by the second episode. It's like, wow, it's not that the special effects are bad. It's that, you know, they get repeated, you know, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. You know, so by episode 3 or 4, it's like you recognize all of these shots by heart. You know, it's like, wow, that takes a little thrill out of it. So.
Okay, but at the same time, if we're talking about what carries meaning and significance, a lot of it often comes from repetition. You know, things which, things that ingrain in us, and in ways that sometimes sort of ingrain in the wrong ways, sort of become the things which remain culturally memorable, aren't they? I mean, things like the launch tube sequence of Battlestar Galactica is probably one of the most memorable things about it. And yet, as you say, they overuse that over and over and over again. A lot of the time, to fill time, I think a lot of the time was. It was not just to... But in some ways, that sort of as a kid became almost like a sort of a signifier to get excited about when you sort of saw them switching on the power to their ships.
Absolutely.
It became something you knew was going to happen.
Right, it's funny you pointed that out. I think that's so true, because one of the things I remember, like, so clearly about Battlestar Galactica, which is so interesting to me, and I still think about this, and I don't remember the actress's name, but there was a bridge officer on the Galactica who would, like, control, like, the launch, and, you know, she'd say, no, and, like, every week you saw her for a couple minutes, and you're nothing about her character, but she was, like, doing a job, you know? It's like, wow. And, like, when I think about Battlestar Galactica, I think, like, the bridge converting to red light,
yes.
I think of the job she's doing, getting all these Viper squadrons to launch, you know? It's like, I'm not sure there was great drama to that, but there was something really interesting and human about the idea that we're, here is this young woman on the bridge of a, you know, futuristic aircraft carrier, essentially, doing her job, and you're sort of focusing on that, and the, you know, the tubes, as you said, and it's like you're sort of getting this nuts and bolts of like, how do you launch, you know, for battle? How does that work? I mean, it's a crazy thing to think about, but I mean, I remember that so vividly. You know, she had the weird hair that was sort of like loops and stuff. I don't know, but do you remember? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. And I was just thinking that a couple of years later, in Empire Strikes Back, they have the same sort of girl who's sort of a standby iron control when they knock out the Star Destroyer. I think, well, that was Larson's chance to get back at Lucas and go, "You're borrowing, you've taken my girl from my bridge and put her into the rebellion."
Right,
but I think that's a very interesting point, because maybe this is, I mean, this obviously starts to really occur predominantly with the sort of Star Wars, the new Hollywood era, where you get this sort of movement towards, and it was happening before this, to be fair, with 2001 and Dark Star as well, this movement to sort of try and ground science fiction a little more into something that's real. Right. And you can see elements of it popping up in Forbidden Planet to a certain degree, where they start to try and make it as they're having a sort of like a military hierarchy in the Forbidden Planet that's sort of brewing there. But certainly by Battlestar, I mean, Battlestar is obviously, it's an airship carrier, essentially, and they're borrowing from that.
Right. I mean, I always thought, to me, what Battlestar Galactica aimed to be, but would occasionally get lost because they were in such a rush and they didn't really know what stories to tell. For me, what it should have been was From Here to Eternity in Space. You know, I mean, that was sort of the, you know, that should have been almost like, you know, the lives and loves of these warriors, you know, as they're fighting, as they're doing this, you know, but of course there was no time. And so what did we get, you know, sort of instead? We got, like, there was a Shane episode, but which had, again, it had some real value, the Shane. I mean, I remember Red Eye, that, you know, it was Apollo lands on a sort of Western planet. Yeah. And, you know, but the villain was memorable. I mean, it's a Cylon, you know, with one, you know, the one-eyed Cylon that he has to do a shootout with. I mean, I remember that vividly, but I mean, you know, now of course I know it was Shane. There was it was called the Magnificent Warriors, which was like the Magnificent Seven or Seven Samurai or something. You know, they were constantly, it's like, wow. And I know they were under a terrible rush. It's just like there wasn't the, I think, time to develop maybe the stories they would have wanted to. And maybe they were able to develop, going back to your question, the pilot enough to where we felt like this is a real world. I mean, like, I remember the one of the things I liked about it was we actually saw, like, the media on Caprica, and Serena was the news person.
Yeah.
You know, again, there was an attempt to, like, create a real world here, you know, right down to the fact that they used, like, different words, like Centon and Yaren and stuff. Like, you know, there was a lexicon. You know, you really felt like they were – there's a lot in that pilot. And then to some extent, you know, then, you know, 9 or 10 weeks later, you're at the Towering Inferno in space. You know, it's like, oh, okay. We sort of lost the thread there. We really created this thing, you know, right down to what the media looks like. We're showing you the nuts and bolts of what a Viper launch is like. We're showing you all these things, and then it swoops right into the word you used before, which is like very generic television. Like, this week will be our Raymond Burr Perry Mason mystery on the ship, you know, Murder on the Rising Star. It's like, oh man, you started out with this great flourish of imagination, and then, you know, midway through, you sort of lost that.
I mean, that's the nature of the medium, isn't it? And
this is
what we say about the genericness of Larson, is they all had the episode where the hero wanders onto the farm that's owned by the woman and her daughter and her son, and the husband figure, the patriarchal figure's gone, and there's a sheriff or a corporation that's wanting to take the land. You know, you'll right. see that in every one of Larson's variants.
Single woman in jeopardy.
Yeah, that's single woman in jeopardy. Absolutely. If you
single
know,
mother in jeopardy. Right, right. That's on Buck Rogers. It was called the Seder. But it was a good episode because that one was like it had a subtext about alcoholism or something. You know, it was like interesting. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, it's the same thing over and over again. It's like it just.
But this was done over and over. I mean, you'd get that obviously in The Fugitive. You'd get that in the A Team. Well, okay, that A Team is perhaps a close Larson thing as well. But this sort of thing still happens. I mean, I find it amazing. We don't do that one as much, but you'll find every sort of a drama these days, even if they're the sort of quality of The Blacklist or whatever, they'll always do the bank heist episode where people are trapped in the bank for some reason. And, you know, these common tropes will, because, you know, they form very good episode structures. They structure for episodic television very well. And
you know, James, that's a great point. And I mean, I have to say, as somebody who loves this, I love like organizing that. Like, I love looking at these crazy things and seeing like all these commonalities. Like, there's just a single mother in Jeopardy. Like, you got one in MacGyver. You got one even in V. It's called, I think it's called The Wildcat. I mean, it's like, wow, it's amazing to see how these move across genres, across producers, and like the little, you know, infinitesimal variations. I mean, or you know, the TV show that does the Die Hard ripoff. Larson did one of these in his superhero show Nightman, where they did a Die Hard knockoff. Even Star Trek: The Next Generation did a Die Hard knockoff with like Picard as, you know, John McClane. It's called Starship Mine. I mean,
yes, I remember it.
It's just crazy how these, you know, but also, in some weird way, for someone like me, comforting, I guess.
Well, that's it. That they are comfort zones, aren't they? People come in, they don't mind having, and this is the point of genre to some degree, is that people like to see something that they have some assumptions that they can already are going to be realized. So they sort of know the direction it's going to go, and it's the satisfaction of seeing the resolutions and the evolutions that you're sort of expecting, which is,
right,
you know, why people crave for, you know, reboots or sequels, or, you know, you're looking for those same sort of moments. And why we rewatched Star Wars 20 times. You've seen it 19 of the times you've, you know, you've seen it before, but you're watching it because you're looking for those elements that really excite you. And I think it's kind of interesting with this sort of generic period of television where some of these factors I found were more enjoyable than later on when you get to the 90s. Like, for instance, I love the fact that Star Trek used to use very, with some additions as seasons went on, very similar stock music. And so when you'd hear a certain rhythm coming up or a certain melody or riff, it would excite you because you'd know the direction it was going in. Come to the Next Generation, where each episode was individually orchestrated, you lose some of that. You lose those markers. You lose those tags.
Absolutely. I mean, the you know, the fight music between Kirk and Spock in Amok Time.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Can be recycled. It's like, man, you know, I think I would have jumped out of my seat and applauded if, you know, a Next Generation episode had, you know, suddenly, you know, got into that during a fight scene.
Exactly.
You know, like, oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's true. And, you know, I have these talks with my son who's 10, you know, because he doesn't see these movies. But, you know, like Halloween or, you know, new James Bond films. I mean, I'm always really disappointed. Like, you know, Rob Zombie said, well, I'm not going to use the Halloween theme. And I say to my son, you know, I don't understand. You know, doesn't he realize we go to these Halloween movies? You know, one of the reasons we go is so we hear the Halloween theme again. Or, you know, when we see a new James Bond movie, yeah, it's going to be a new James Bond. It's not going to be the Cold War. It's not going to be Sean Connery or Roger Moore. But I still want to hear that theme a lot. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it means something to us.
Exactly. It's the comfort and expectation we derive from the familiar.
Yeah.
And we want that. We want that in our art. The question is it good for us in our art, and do we get too much of it? You know, are we being pandered to sometimes, you know, with things that are too familiar? And, I mean, maybe this would be a good time to discuss The Force Awakens.
Well, absolutely. And I've been, again, arguing this on the internet. Just, well, I know that sounds really bad because that's a really bad thing to be doing these days, consider the arguing on the internet. There was someone on Facebook who put up a post which, so they were defending The Force Awakens against this post which was pulling it apart. And I think with things like The Force Awakens, the issue is not so much the nostalgia. I think it's when there's the fear in the industry affects what, to me, The Force Awakens is like an essay. If you get an essay, and if you've marked an essay or you've had to look at an essay, and you get a title and you think, oh, that's an interesting title, and then this essay goes in a different direction to the title, and you're thinking, this is interesting, but this isn't what you said you were going to do. And for The Force Awakens, you've got a very clear, you know, it is the hunt for Skywalker. It's the search for Luke Skywalker, who will get there first. It's essentially, it's more of the structure it's suggesting is more of a Raiders of the Lost Ark action adventure. You know,
right.
Who will get to find Luke Skywalker first? The New Order's after Luke Skywalker. They're after this map plan. So is the Rebellion. Who's going to get there? But in the end, it suddenly deviates into this Starkiller Death Star base. And you suddenly think, well, what's this got to do with the title here? And suddenly it's almost as if the need to replicate what was successful to make sure that this is successful becomes too overpowering. And it's not so much maybe about the nostalgia, but the fact that what Star Wars did originally worked, so it starts to mimic that in the hope that it sort of carries that same success, particularly to a new generation.
And so where do we draw the line between the things we want to see again and the things that when we see them again we roll our eyes, we're like, not again. It's the Death Star. It's only bigger.
Yeah, but did people want to see the Death Star again? That's what I would wonder. Was that something that was intrinsic? I'm asking you that actually as a question more than as a rhetorical.
Oh, well, I did not. I mean, I was one of the people when I watched Return of the Jedi felt very let down that the Death Star was a repeat, you know, so you had three Star Wars movies at that point, and two of them, you know, featured the destruction of the Death Star as the, you know, climactic sequence, and that just seemed terribly non-creative to me. And so then to recycle it yet again, but to really do it badly, I mean, like, I didn't, like, understand all the mechanics of the Star Killer base, and the final assault on it was not very suspenseful. So I thought, okay, so this is the third time in seven Star Wars movies where we've had the attack on this sort of battle station, and, you know, it was done better the previous two times. And so I was like, yeah, I didn't want to see that again. I want to see more of the Star Wars universe. I mean, honestly, I'm thrilled, you know, about the idea of Rogue One, even though the Death Star is in it, but it's not about destroying the Death Star, right?
I did wonder when I was having this argument whether the mistake was, and I know we're ending up on The Force Awakens here, but was whether they... because they took out the politics out of The Force Awakens, you lack the framing to make Starkiller seem relevant at all. So you get this feeling this is all about Skywalker, then suddenly it lurches to about this Death Star that's to do with this Republic that we've not been told about, or this this break-off splinter group which we've not been told about. And suddenly everything feels really disjointed. And maybe it was that lack of confidence in the political elements which was needed to create the framework that would make Starkiller and that direction seem relevant to the movie. But because you don't have that, right. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, they're expecting us to take a lot sort of assumed. It's like, well, I want to know what the New Order is. I want to know what the Knights of Ren are. I want to know where this guy came from who the Supreme Leader Snoke, you know, there's a sense of, like, we're landing you into these ingredients and you should already know everybody's alliances and, you know, what side they're on and why it matters, you know, but we don't. We're dropped into that. And so that all we can do is sort of recognize the elements, and then the elements are taken to be enough of a signifier of what it represents. Starkiller base, big battle station, evil like the Death Star, people in uniform. You know, so,
absolutely.
You need something more than a symbol there, I think, for that movie to completely work.
And to be fair to Star Wars, and to be fair to Lucas, for once, as very few people are, there was enough dialogue, I think, in the first act that sets up the background. They don't make it. It doesn't make it's not a big issue like in the prequels. But he does. They talk about the rebellion. They talk about the Imperial Senate. They talk about the the takeover of the Republic. So these things are factored in. They're not, you know, they're not focused on. But you get the feeling of where the universe, the status quo is. Within that first act, while in Force Awakens, you don't really have any clue about the universe at all until Leia appears in the second act, and that's way past. And even then, you're not really sure where she relates to, because you're thinking, well, why is she not with the New Republic? Why are they a splinter group? And because all that stuff was taken out, So yes, it's interesting, isn't it?
It is. We seek in our entertainment the familiar but not the too familiar. It's like there's a line there that trips, I guess, at least maybe, you know, for some people, that it's like, okay, you're just giving me what you gave me before, but you're not doing it well. You know, you have to give me the things I want and do it well, I guess. I don't know. That's real demanding. I don't know.
It is. But I think that's where, if we go back to Larson and Battlestar Galactica, it's possibly where, for me, I know a lot of people unhappy with the last two seasons of it, but the reimagining one by Moore worked for me because there was enough nods to the past without feeling constrained by it, which I thought was, even if you don't like what it did in the end, it did respect its original material, but it wasn't controlled by it.
Well, you know, I think that's a good argument. You know, I was not, you know, for me, the changes were so radical from the old Galactica that I had a hard time taking that one on its own terms when it came out. I'd like to go probably revisit it now, but for, you know, for me, one, you know, some sort of reboot like that I think actually has worked and might be illuminating to discuss why, you know, why I really like the sequence of Planet of the Apes reboots we have now, but I hated the Tim Burton attempt to do it. You know,
it's like, as most did.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, there's some, and I think that, I think Battlestar Galactica and Planet of the Apes have something in common there. The reboots, that they both took a lot of the, I don't know, the basics of their original premise, let's say, and then that, but then they really thought about it, I think, in a very different way, and in some way, oh god, I want to be careful how I say it, in a more evolved way. I don't know, and it's like you can either make that jump with them or and love it, or if you don't, you're not going to buy into it. I don't know.
I mean, there was things with Galactica. What I liked was, while I thought the way it sort of sat sort of culturally at the time after 9/11 was interesting, but for me there was things it was doing which I think I craved in the original, and I craved in Voyager, which more initially had involvement in, which I thought was set up to sort of do a Battlestar Galactica that would end up being a ragtag fleet because they were so far away from home, they would be able to maintain their ship, and their ship was, you know, mixed with tensions within it. But I like the fact that we got to see the Colonial Fleet, which they did do in the original Battlestar, but you kind of feel they never did in the way that the pilot sets up. You know, you've got all these political struggles in there. You've got these social... How do people survive in this ragtag fleet? And these are the really exciting things in the pilot, which occasionally get addressed a little bit in the season, the one season, but never to the way that you really hope for. And it was really gratifying for me to see that in the reimagined one, that they were able to explore those, and sometimes not perfectly, but that to me was the fascination of Battlestar in the original, which I always craved to see, was this, you know, how does this mini society, this micro society exist? How does it hold itself together?
Well, that is a great point. And, you know, again, it brings us back to this idea in the Larson pilot, you know, that there's this middle section of the pilot where the warriors are going to some freighter, and you see how the people live, like they're living like what looks like a boiler room, real, you know, and that's where they find Cassiopeia, and she's a socialator, which is their word for prostitute, and you're seeing a little bit of the underbelly of the society, and nobody has food, but then there's a rich person who has food, Sire or Yuri, you know, you're right, that it was like all set up there to show you what it was going to be like to live in this, in these environs, and then the season didn't really follow up on that until, you know, by the end, and, you know, when you're like in Galactica 1980, it's like now we're talking about, you know, kids with superpowers dressed up like Boy Scouts trying to win a baseball game. You know, it's like, wow, how did we get, you know, from, you know, this, like, you know, the struggles of living, you know, as refugees, essentially, to, you know, this sort of generic nonsense.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there was a certain brilliance to what he would steal or borrow or homage that would be there that would never get brought to fruition. Again, if you look at Buck Rogers, you have this fantastically quite melancholy thing of this person who's outside its time in an Earth which is, you know, barren bar a couple of cities, it seems, you know, that where everyone exists, and how they're trying to where that's left them, where their over-reliance on technology, all these sort of questions, which again sort of gets lost. And even Knight Rider, again, where you've got this whole thing about, which is totally forgotten, about him being made in the image into a new image, you know, a new life. You know, the car is almost secondary to this whole situation of him being reborn from Michael Long to Michael Knight. And again, it does get picked up a couple of times, but it never really answers these sort of questions, these quite sort of intellectual questions, which his pilots often offered.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, Buck Rogers has these moments that I find fascinating. There's, you know, this great matte painting of them, stepping out into Anarchia or whatever they call it, you know, the ruins of Chicago, and the possibilities of that, you know, just from that image, you know, and what could be out there, you know, never explored again, but fascinating. And, you know, it's just crazy. You know, Buck Rogers drives me crazy because it's got its own little sort of internal inconsistency there. So, you know, it's like, okay, so mankind destroyed himself, you know, in a nuclear holocaust in the 1980s, right? So people have because of that and their situation, have sort of become more stoic and are relying on machines because they're afraid of irrational decisions, right? So what do they do when they meet someone from the 90s? You know, let's, you know, yeah, you know, we got to go back to being like that, the people who destroyed us. You
yeah.
know? It's like a weird closed loop of American exceptionalism.
Yes.
You know, it's like, yeah, we got to bring forward this guy from the time where we launched nukes and destroyed the planet, because shooting from the hip, you know, and not relying on things like facts and computers, that's what'll get us to the future.
This is always it's always a fascination, isn't it, with action series and action films as well, is you have this real tension between sort of progressive ideas, which they tend to be, you know, that you'll tend to find in most, they'll be culturally progressive in some ways, that they'll look after sort of, they'll be there to try and stop. Are they? Yeah, I think they are. I mean, things like, you know, with Battlestar Galactica, you've got, you know, that you accept the society, the prostitutes, basically, that, you know, that these are, that you respect them, that, you know, that right. there's often these pressures of trying to push forward women's as being equals, and yet at the same time the action hero is always a very right-wing character, and by its essence, that you know that it's very black and white, that, you know, everything's very, even progressive morality becomes black and white as well. You're either, you know, and if you don't stand for it, you're shot or you're thrown into a garbage compactor, or, you know, if you stand against the progressive element of the right, you know, of the hero, and, you know, family values are extremely important, and traditions to some degree. There's this real mixture of left and right in these sort of things.
It's got to go back to the fact that, you know, in the past, TV, as you said, was so generic, you know, because you had to appeal to the widest possible audience. So you can go so far with what you think you want your stance to be, of like what the future would be like, but you've got to pull it back to like, okay, I want mom and dad and, you know, little Johnny and little whatever Jill, you know, to be watching this at 8 o'clock on Sunday night, and, you know, they can't be, you know, debauched by, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, like with fourth season of Knight Rider, where RC appears, the urban sort of slight thief stroke gangster sort of black character who appears, who incidentally for English people is very funny, because RC is in the letters, sounds like RC is in an arse. So
oh, no.
it was even more amusing when Michael would ask for RC, you know, where's RC? Hilarious. But I mean, you got there where you're sort of trying to highlight sort of, and obviously appeal to sort of minority groups in your demographics, and sort of show some acceptance in them, yet at the same time you've still got this very libertarian right-wing approach to justice, to
right.
to action, to dealing with issues, and it's a they are really, because you say that they're trying to appeal to everyone and thus no one, and it is
exactly right.
It is the brilliant thing about this era of television, which we still have in films. I mean, I remember watching one of the recent Die Hards, the one where he goes to Russia, and I was watching this, and I'm thinking, my God, this is just so right-wing, I never realised. So it still exists in films, but it's in television, because, as we say, it's become more nuanced and more audience-focused. You get a little less of it.
Right.
The boundaries are a little less blurred, or a little more blurred, sorry.
Or they take a stance and you sort of know, okay, this show is going to be evidencing this kind of belief system, and that's okay. It doesn't feel the need to say, this is my belief system, but then I'm going to cut back and give you all these other things from an opposite belief system.
But maybe they do, because, I mean, I was just thinking then, you think of House or even The Blacklist, where you have a central character who is both progressive in the way they, but yet at the same time does have sort of very core unsympathetic non-empathetic values are being promoted, and which audiences enjoy. I mean, I enjoy seeing House turn around and sort of totally pull apart, you know, these two people who he'll actually expose as being adulterers, and, you know, break down their role as the victims into actually being sort of perpetrators. And there's something very satisfying in that. But it is a very right-wing approach. It's not a very sort of caring, progressive, liberal approach to things. But he exists in a world where he is trying to help people that other people wouldn't normally help. Especially, you know, and the same with Blacklist as well. You know, he goes against the sort of authoritarian values of you know, of protection through the FBI and all those, by defying it. But yet the way he defies it is in very brutal, cold, black and white terms again. And yet he himself is a very liberal character, the James Spader character. So yeah, it's still there, but in different ways. It's,
right. No, that's a good point. That's a really good point. You know, and it's funny because maybe because as you get further to the fringe of stuff like that, you know, they say once you get to like the far right wing and the far left wing, they're indistinguishable.
Absolutely. But maybe that is what makes, as you say, House and James Spader's characters so fascinating in those shows, because they are both, aren't they? They are very left, and yet they're also very right. They're sort of left in sort of ideology, right in action. Maybe, right. I don't know, but again, yeah, so actually being able to define whether they are sort of a left-wing character or a right-wing character becomes nearly impossible. And in a sense, maybe again, even though we've narrowed in our audience focuses for advertising and the like, somehow we are still very broad. We are trying to touch everyone of every value.
Well, and you know, that brings up a point that I think is not explored enough about Battlestar Galactica. People tend to dismiss it as popcorn, but if you look at that pilot, it was clearly forecasting the Reagan presidency and the approach to the USSR. You know, it begins with this sort of weak-kneed president who wants to make peace with the Cylons. That's Adar, played by Lou Ayres, of course, who is a famous pacifist. You know, and the Cylons, who are the communists, you know, they're all alike. You know, that's how Hollywood does communists. You know, if you're a communist, that means you have like no soul and, you know, red eye. You know, you know, they trick them, and society is destroyed because, you know, we weren't vigilant enough. You know, it wasn't peace through strength. We were capitulating to the Cylons. And what it was about, of course, was the SALT Treaty at the time. You know, that the right wing elements in the United States didn't want us to have this missile treaty with the Soviet Union, and they thought if you make a treaty with the Soviet Union, they're just going to abuse it and destroy you. I mean, and that is actually the fulcrum of what Battlestar Galactica is at its beginning. And, you know, you have Adama who says, you know, they hate us with every fiber of their being. You know, he's a cold warrior. You know, in space, all warriors are cold warriors. He's a cold warrior, and he sees through it, and, you know, he preserves the Galactica and what have you. But, I mean, it's very much this sort of peace through strength ideal, and what's amazing is that actually does come back in the series later on in an episode called Experiment in Terra, where Apollo goes before a planet of like the Eastern Alliance and Western Alliance and talks about the only way to have peace is peace through strength. I mean, and that is like literally the name of the foreign policy platform in the Republican Party under Reagan. You know, so it's like crazy how it forecasts and reflects that time period in our culture. And, you know, people want to say, you know, Battlestar Galactica has no real social meaning. Well, if you look at it, it kind of does.
Absolutely.
It kind of has this real right-wing Cold War 1979-1978 mentality to it, which I find fascinating. But then, what's really fascinating is that they mix that with mythology, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, which would be the Nova of Madagon with the mines, you know, things like that. You know, I don't know, the Exodus. So, you know, Glenn Larson actually, there really is some stuff going on in Battlestar Galactica that separates it from Star Wars and is interesting, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, someone has always, I can't remember who said it, but there was a very nice point, though. He said the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars is, might have been crack.com probably, somewhere, some deep intellectual resources there. You know, the beauty is that Star Trek is about, or it might even be you knowing what I've read, that Star Trek is about is about examining or reflecting cultural and relevant cultural ideologies and politics, right, while Star Wars remains sort of non-temporal. It's atemporal. It's it carries no synchronicity with society, that it's meant to be sort of set out there, so it doesn't really reflect what's going on. It's purely fantasy, it's purely about fairy tale, so you don't really get it's untrue, because you will see cultural values in there, but to some degree that it's not a commentary so much as, say, Battlestar and Star Trek is.
No, I think you're right. I mean, to me, Star Wars, you know, at its essence, is myth. It is, you know, mythic structure. So, and sometimes commentary does get in. But, you know, Star Trek, just by its nature and by, like you said, by its medium, you see it every week. It can be a polemic. Star Trek is often a, you know, polemic. It's about a social event. I mean, you've had Star Trek episodes about things as mundane as, like, healthcare, you know, on Voyage. You know, an episode about, you know, people needing healthcare, you know, in their society and not getting it, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I like Star Wars and Star Trek very much, but I guess I've Star Trek just because there's so much more of it and that it can go to another level, which for me rewards rewatching on a level I can't do with Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars I've rewatched, you know, hundreds of times, but, you know, like Star Trek can just go back and back even more than that. It's like, at some point it's like you can only dissect Star Wars so much for the mythic elements. But Star Trek, you know, becomes like this rabbit hole of like influences and what was going on in the culture and through different decades, because you've had so many different Star Treks, you know. And
but I think that's why Star Wars is a problem, why they have a problem remaking it, is that there isn't really anything to remake. I mean, the world has expanded from its extended universe more than the actual. You don't really get much of a world build. You get the sort of, you get a truth within the films that you believe. But I always felt when I was thinking, you know, how do you expand Star Wars? It's like, I mean, Empire and Star Wars could be totally different universes in a lot of ways. They don't feel the same. The aesthetics are all there and the characters are there. But because it's all about, you know, these sort of fairy tale and myths, Empire doesn't carry that same familiarity that you feel in Star Wars. And it's a harder thing, I think, as you say, to replicate because of that.
I think that's true. I think that's very true. You know, it'll be interesting to see what Star Trek Discovery is like. What values it carries forward, and how it expresses those values. You know, and even, you know, as mundane as what is, you know, what is outer space going to look like? What are the outer space scenes are going to look like? Are they going to look like the Abrams Trek movies? Or are they going to look more like, you know, traditional Trek? You know, it's just going to be very interesting to see how that goes.
Well, I mean, I think we should probably wrap this up. I mean, this is, I think, again, what's nice about it is that while we talk about Larson, it's obviously expanded out beyond it, because as we say, all these things are interconnected and they inform our understanding of each of those things as well. How we see Star Trek, we relate to Star Wars, not just in that internet, which has got the which would destroy the other sort of debate, but in, you know, that whole what do they mean to each other and what does that mean to us? Why do we extend meaning? Why do we get territorial over one over the other? I think these are all really interesting questions, and I certainly think Larson, to me anyway, I think that's the mixture, as we say, of the sameness and difference. And one final question I will ask you is to do with Knight Rider. Why do you think, despite the fact there's been there was the two pilot films in the 90s, there was Team Knight Rider in the 90s, there was a Knight Rider series a few years ago, and they're now in the middle of doing another Knight Rider series, why have they all failed bar the original?
This is a crazy answer, but I truly believe it in my heart. The relationship between Michael and Kit and the chemistry between the actors, even though one was merely a voice, there was a magic there that people had a people love their cars and wish their cars could talk to them and wish that their cars could banter with them. And it was almost a Spock-Kirk relationship, you know, between Kit and Michael. You know, and so, you know, the car is the machine and the human is the emotional human, and yet they love each other and they're both sort of fully realized people. And I think that unless you are able to replicate that somehow, that chemistry, that unique chemistry, you're not going to have a successful Knight Rider. That's what people want to see. That's the relationship that matters to people. I mean, you can talk all you want about the various and sundry limitations of a David Hasselhoff or a William Shatner, but you watch them do what they do with Leonard Nimoy or William Daniels. I hope I got that name right.
Yeah.
There's something magical there.
Yeah,
And that's all. You know, I mean, Star Trek has managed to move beyond that and recreate that in some way. You know, Brent Spiner and Patrick Stewart. You know, they found corollaries for that in more recent iterations of Star Trek. I don't know that happened in Knight Rider.
Yeah, I think Knight Rider. I think that's probably a very good point. I think that's possibly one of the core structural elements. They've just not replicated in any of those versions. I suppose they tried to in the two pilots, or one of the pilots where they did do that, where it was a Knight Rider 2000, wasn't it? or was it two?
Yes.
Which was the one which was had Hasselhoff come back with the cast as well. But that didn't quite work, but it was the nearest thing to working. So
you can have a reunion, but that's not the same thing as the concept going on to sort of a new generation. I don't know.
I think there's a mixture of things, like everything. I think what you've said there, the core thing which Larson got right, and what he did frequently get right, to be fair, was, well, certainly in the pilots that went forward, was that innate, that partnership factor, whether it's in Alias Smith and Jones, whether it's with Battlestar Galactica with Benedict and Hatch.
Right, Starbuck and Apollo.
You've got to have that sort of, that chemistry is key. I think also, perhaps, not necessarily the structure, the formula structure, but I think there's got to be certain elements which, for me as a kid, Knight Rider was also about, you know, it was a cool car, the buttons as well, the later variations. The cars, to me, never seemed very cool. They seemed to be perhaps things which sponsorship brought them. And there was insides where there was very little buttons, or the recent version where they tried to add the Transformer element. And I was thinking, that's probably not really what people are after. But I think you're right. I think the core factor that to make it work has to be that chemistry. You get that in any of these reboots. I think even with The Force Awakens, the reason The Force Awakens has been popular is less actually to do with its, well, to harking back to the past, but also the fact that they're Rey and Finn have a nice chemistry which bounce off each other, which makes people think, I could see another film with these guys without Harrison Ford.
Absolutely. The cast is very good. They're very appealing. And you think, I could see them in many stories, some of which may be better than this.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. And that's what we're hoping for, something better. But so, no, I think that's interesting. Where does it go wrong? Because, say, Knight Rider is coming back again. And one of my colleagues says, whenever he actually interviews any of these industry types, is he says, why do you keep rebooting? Because he says, you know, your success rate on a TV reboot is actually extremely low. And yet the industry tends to always see this as a way forward of... It's what I always say to students, you know, is what we always say. It's not just me, but it's what every scholar sort of says. You know, this is, you know, it's a very risky industry. You know, audiences are not predictable. It is hard to predict the people that you're selling to. So it makes it a very risky industry to be part of. And in that sense, reboots don't always work. They don't, their success rate is fairly low, yet they're still very popular. So it'll be interesting to see whether this Knight Rider, as you say, listens to you and gets that core chemistry right. Because I think you're right. I think if you do that, and you keep these from being, and you allow that to become the living, breathing part of it, you might have a series which works on its own.
I think it's possible. You know, the other thing too is that there was the sense in the original Knight Rider, and to some sense in the original Star Trek as well, that there was a joy about itself and a lightness about itself.
Yeah.
And series made today and movies made today, now this is a gross exaggeration, but in broad terms, feel the need to be very serious, to be very gritty, to be seen as very realistic. And they seem to have lost the ability to sort of transmit that sense of joy. I mean, that's what I say when you get something like out of a Hasselhoff or a Shatner. There's the sense that they're having a good time with themselves, and that they're taking it seriously, but they also know that there's some other element to this.
Yeah. Absolutely. We've lost, I think also that comes with the seriality, I can't say it, over sort of procedural, where I think the beautiful thing with Knight Rider and that era, because we're talking about it being very broad and trying to appeal to many people, and thus you want to try and make a lot of standalone stories so you can sell them and package them and they don't have to be in order and all that sort of thing, which was part of that era.
Right.
The beautiful thing of that is you get a lot of freedom, that you feel that the world starts to feel bigger because you're not constantly going back to the same places. You're going to different places each week. And Knight Rider in itself was on the road, wasn't it? It was a very feeling of that sort of on the road sort of format. And I think the recent variations haven't had that.
I think so too. I think that is absolutely true. That, you know, we think, oh, we've developed, TV has developed so much as an art form because we have gone to, you know, serialized stories, and stories have consequences on the characters, and the characters always clearly carry with them. But you've lost something. You know, there has, you know, and I'm not saying one is better than the other, but one of the things that I think they didn't realize they were going to lose was very much that sense and that sort of freedom to fail. Like, this week is going to be a complete one-off where we have like little furry balls, you know, invade the ship that, you know, procreate out of control. You know what I'm saying? You won't get that in a serialized. You won't get a Trouble with Tribbles, or you won't get something like that.
But you get it in Monk. You know, there are some genres still allow it to some degree, but right. Others don't.
Exactly. And so you do lose those things, those moments where it's like, you know, if you totally fail, well, that's okay. Next week, everyone will
exactly.
have forgotten
yeah.
anyway.
And that can become quite charming. And it also means that when you do get that serial nature, it becomes quite exciting because it's rare. You get that
right.
moment where it does relate back to something previous. And oh, wow, that's cool. You know, Kirk has referenced something that happened, you know, which was very rare. There's only a few instances where it happens, where they turn around and sort of say, yeah, that actually is part of, you know, we did that many, many episodes ago.
Right. Right. When he talked in the deadly years, he'd used the same Corbomite bluff that he used.
Exactly.
You know, the Corbomite, and it was like, oh, wow, this show remembers what it did, you know?
And one of the wonderful things with Star Trek, I know we're going off piste again and we should end, but one of the things I loved about it was that that the crew, that largely, by and large, they kept a lot of the same support cast. And we're not talking about Chekhov and that. We're talking about people actually on the ship would reappear
right.
again. May not
Mr.
Some,
Kyle.
Yes.
Mr. Leslie. And,
Leslie
yeah.
might, their name might occasionally shift. That did happen. Or one might occasionally die, then reappear again. Right. Leslie being the one of them. But you had a certain structure of that sort of familiarity. So while you didn't, the episodes didn't have to refer to each other, if you carried similar sort of crew complement, it kind of felt that sort of gave it its world. And Galactica did that to a degree as well.
Yes, I think so. And but Galactica, you know, again, too, you know, it didn't, you know, and I know this was actually used against it when the new Galactica came out. They said, you know, the whole human race has been destroyed. What are you going to do? Go gamble in a casino? You know, I'd say we're going to take this premise seriously now, you know, but it's like, you know, some of the lightness of the original Galactica is what gave it its sense of charm.
Yeah, no, I agree. And to be honest, these days I look and I think, if the world ended, I could imagine people heading to the casino in the same way that people will head to Facebook. As soon as there's bad stuff, they will go and find solace in something, or maybe even a DVD box set of a show that was shown in 1981. That, you know, when things get bad, people go to safe zones. So I could imagine a casino being a big thing, you know, if the world was about
right.
to end. So, again, it's interesting reflections on who we are. And
it's crazy, James.
The 80s and this sort of, you know, puff pastry sort of television, I think, you know, we can find a lot in there to talk about.
Oh, I think so too. I mean, it's really amazing. Well, I mean, it's crazy. You even think about, you know, Westworld is popular right now, and I like to raise my hand when people are watching Westworld. You know, this isn't the first Westworld TV series. There was a really bad one in 1980 that we can talk about.
I've not seen it, so I've only watched the first episode of the new Westworld. So once I've finished that this Christmas, maybe that's one that we can talk about, and you can tell us what a lot of people listening to this will not know, unless they've read your blog, that there was a very short-lived Westworld show.
Absolutely, Beyond Westworld, and it was all about like the infiltration of society by, you know, androids, you know, sleeper cells. I mean, it's crazy because in a way it really forecasted the twist in the new Battlestar Galactica. You know, there's just a year. You know, the person next to you is a Cylon, you know? The person next to you is an android. So it's just interesting how those ideas kind of – it's like it had a real post 9/11 feel in 1980 and totally didn't resonate with anybody.
Oh, so. Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting because I suppose it was a little too far away from the fear of, you know, the communist fear, the commie,
right.
the enemy within.
Exactly.
And yeah, obviously it hadn't predicted the 9/11 and the repercussions of that, where again people feel the terrorism of fear was heightened, and you know, who is the terrorist, which so no, it's interesting where you say where they're situated can inform their success or not.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's just crazy to think about the weird cycles we go on through our entertainment and how Battlestar Galactica, it's happened before and it'll happen again. I mean, that could be the mantra for cult television in almost everything we've talked about, from Star Trek to V to Battlestar Galactica. I guess we haven't gotten another iteration of Buck Rogers yet, but I'm sure it's only a matter of time.
Did you ever see it? There was that one that Gerard and Aaron did that was a web series that they were doing. I don't know whether they completed it, where they were playing the parents to a new Buck Rogers.
I did watch that. I had high hopes that, you know, that would become something and we would, you know, kind of get that next iteration. But I guess there's some story about why that didn't work, but I don't know what it is.
But saying that, it is actually, they've done books, haven't they? They've done a spin-off series, a recent series of Buck Rogers books, which are based on that Buck Rogers universe.
Yeah, which I think is great. I mean, I always enjoyed Buck Rogers. I think even as a kid, I knew it was kind of silly, but I loved it anyway.
Hmm. But that's it. I mean, Buck Rogers. Again, so much we could talk about. We should end it off here. Thank you guys for listening to whatever this show is called. Like I said, you will know this. We don't. You are more informed than we are. So that's, I love that sort of feel. That's kind of exciting. Well, I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any, I'm not sure how we're sending this out. That's up to Christian, who runs Beyond Casterbrus. In whatever format you listen to this. I'm sure you can find ways to contact us. They'll probably be in whatever show notes is on the website. Thank you, John. We will be doing this, as I say, it's a regular. It won't be weekly, it won't be monthly, it'll be whenever time allows us. And we hope that you'll tune in. And if you don't, I think we'll just enjoy talking to each other. So, yeah.
I loved it, James. Thank you so much. Looking forward to the next time.
Take care, everyone.